But tonight's talk is about the seven steps
to heaven.
To heaven, yes, and one beyond, which is negotiated by the management of this joint because they're Miles Davis fans. I don't remember seeing Miles Davis. So I think especially it's supposed to be about the jhanas and the very deep meditations. Now, first of all, sometimes people say, oh, that's such high stuff. But nevertheless, people actually experience those things. And sometimes just by chance. Tomorrow when I go to Penang, once I was teaching a retreat there, and they introduced this woman who was not on retreat with me, but she said she had an experience which was so strange and disconcerting for her that she thought she had a psychosis, to the point when she made appointments through her GP with psychologists and psychiatrists, and no one was really able to understand what she was doing. And why? So that's when she came and they said, Ajahn Brahm, can you sort of help out? And I'm always just, sometimes too obliging. But I don't mind. So I obliged and said, no, what happened? What happened? And she had flew to jhana. Mm. You know, she had what we call pressing the letting go button. And she had these incredible deep experiences. And I said, oh, that was only a jhana. That's all. And are you sure? And then I said all the other things which she would have experienced. And oh, that's what it was. At last, I understand what it is. I'm not mad. I'm not crazy. Because when you start to develop these deep states of meditation, which are not just for Theravada, they're in Mahayana, Vajrayana, they're all through Buddhism. They're amazing states, but they're really weird and strange. Not like you've had before. And that's one of the reasons why. If you don't know what they are, if you haven't had some instructions or some explanations what they are and how they work, sometimes if they just happen, you get very afraid. And just like just on one of the retreats, just yesterday, one of the retreatants there, she wasn't actually in the jhana yet, but an incredibly powerful nimitta, a light, which came up. We call them nimittas in Theravada. It was so powerful that she was so amazingly joyful and blissed, but it started to suck her in, and it scared her. She didn't know what the heck is going on. Ooh, this is a bit too much for me right now. So as soon as when I explained that, it's only nimittas, it's no danger there at all. You're not going to go crazy. You're not going to go mad. In fact, the only danger, if you do get sent to these jhanas and do them a lot, is you may lose your hair. In other words, because that's what sort of thing happened to me. When I was at Cambridge doing my first meditation retreat, that got into a very, very deep state of meditation. I thought, what the heck was that? Because it was, please excuse the language, because I have to say this just so that you understand what you're dealing with. It was better than sex. I was a young man at the time, had a girlfriend. I just left her in Gloucester, and this was really deep experiences. And, I was a Buddhist, but I wasn't a monk yet, and I started thinking, why has no one ever told me about these things? And then later on, you looked around, and other people do have those experiences too. And when you become a monk, you develop those experiences, or a nun, and you actually find out a huge amount of what Buddhism is. Sometimes you only see a tiny amount of it. You see something much, 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 much bigger of the nature of the human mind. And this is very interesting as even a physicist, as a scientist, that we have the world. What about this thing we call the human mind? What actually is it? And, talking with many, many, many scientists, sometimes I think, it doesn't exist at all. Even though in quantum mechanics it's right there, it's an essential part of the Copenhagen understanding of the Schrodinger's equation. But still, there's a willful ignorance there. There is a little story to say about the willful ignorance and what we call delusion, and why sometimes we can be with something for a long time and just not see it. And the story is, I hope I didn't say this last year, the flower pot experiment at Imperial College. There was, you know, my mate Bernard. You know, did he ever contact you?
No, he didn't.
Okay, I'll see if I can catch up. Professor Bernard Carr, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College. He was a very close friend, and he was the first Buddhist I ever saw. And when I went to Cambridge, he was on a little stall, the Buddhist Society of Cambridge. And the story was, he was there just manning, so he was only a student, 1 or 2 years senior to me. And I said, wow, there's a Buddhist society in this university. Wow, I want to join. I didn't know about the Buddhist Society in London then. It was only later on when Christmas Humphreys told me he used to come every year, I think every term, I think, to give a lecture there. And then when I asked him, I want to join, he said, no, you don't have to join. Just, you know, come and see. Try it out first of all. I said, no, I'm a Buddhist, I want to join. He said, no need to, just come to a few talks. I said, I want to join. And I got angry. And I got out a pound note, slammed it on the desk, write my name down now. And that was Bernard. Came lifelong friends after that. And we're interested in the same sort of things, into psychic research. We were ghost hunters. He was also even currently, the treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London. I forget where it is. It's somewhere around here, somewhere.
Yeah, it's South Kensington.
South Ken. Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. Down there. And anyway, that also he was a Buddhist, but also interestingly, he was a very close disciple of Stephen Hawkins. So close that Stephen came to his wedding with Mary, and also that Bernard was featured on the film, The Theory of Everything. So was invited to Leicester Square to the premiere to walk the red carpet alongside Stephen Hawkins, close friend. So that's how close he was, a Buddhist, and also into to weird stuff. I'm not talking about Buddhism, I'm talking about ghost stuff. So anyway, he told me about the flower pot experiment where over in Imperial College in South Kent, one of the professors, he didn't tell me who, said he was going to demonstrate levitation in a laboratory in front of professors, lecturers, researchers who were all well known in science. And when he got his friends to come and sit down in the lecture theatre, he brought out a flower pot, no wires or anything, and he put it on the bench. And then he had the cameras rolling. You can take your own photos if you wish, but they had infrared cameras, ordinary sort of videos, ultraviolet, just to make sure if it happened, it would be recorded. And he said that he needed the help to create the right atmosphere. And so he asked, can you all please help by chanting the holy word, Om? And I always comment that that was one of the greatest successes, to convince all these crusty old professors sitting in their seats to go, Om, Om, Om. But they did. And as they were chanting, the flower pot rose in the air. It levitated. They had it on camera. They videoed it. It lifted. And afterwards, they asked the professors, what do you think about that? And a couple of them said, it never lifted at all. It was on the table all the time. That was the point of the experiment. Not on levitation, but on perception. Because what was happening underneath that bench, there was a hugely powerful electromagnet, and they needed everybody to start chanting Om. Because if you turn on a large current, you can hear the hum, and the game would be up. But it wasn't the fact that it was trying to deceive the audience. You know, it was sort of, you know, science that it levitated, just electromagnetism. But the point was that many of those scientists refused to admit what they saw in front of their eyes, what was on the canvas. How it is that when we don't want to see, we won't see. Even our bare perceptions, raw data to our mind, will be filtered before we're even mindful of it or conscious of it. Now that is one of the dangers. So, we have little practices in Buddhism, the meditations, where we really get still. And we go to places we've never seen before. As it used to say in Star Trek when I was a kid, to boldly go where no monk or nun has gone before. You remember that? It actually said boldly go, but I changed it to boldly. And so what happens? A lot of times, we learn how to relax. The last thing which I left, the 6,000 Koreans who had just finished the walk in the demilitarized zone, we did a little meditation at the end, and they asked me to give them some advice before I left to come back to Australia. And then I said, I'll teach you a very powerful, simple meditation method. Relax. And the translator translated that into Korean. And they said, you don't need to translate it, now they know the meaning. All of you 6,000, after me, relax. So I had these 6,000 Koreans going, relax. And then the next part is, to the max. And then the translator translated that, to the max. So they all understood. Okay, now, all together, relax to the max. Can you do that? Okay, let's do it. Relax to the max. Oh, that's an important meditation technique. We get sometimes way too tight. There was a psychologist told me that this gentleman came into their consulting rooms, and they said that they had this really weird feeling that they weren't a human being, that they were a marquee. And then, but not always a marquee, sometimes they thought they were a teepee. And the psychologist thought, very, very wise woman, he said, I know what that is. You're too tense. And that's many people are too tense. But not in that way. In the fact that you did hear about the squirrel who was in the the psychologist's couch. A little squirrel was there. What's your point? What are you doing in here? Well, said the squirrel, ever since I read that you are what you eat, I realized I was nuts. But anyway, come and relax, relax. So anyway, it's important when you start any type of mind training to learn how to be at peace, to really relax. Because what happens then when you relax, your body disappears. It was, what was it, Professor Philippe Golding, Stanford University. I'll see him next June, another little conference over there in San Fran. Philippe Golding did some research some years ago, Stanford University, and he wanted to find out, you know, how effective like mindfulness and meditation really was. So he had a whole group of students, giving them credits, you know, for joining in this little experiment. And half of them he sent on to a meditation retreat for the day at Stanford's expense. And the other half, chosen randomly, were sent to a Californian spa for the day, where they had hot rubs, hot tubs, foot massages. I don't know, because I've never been to a Californian spa, but you know, something like that. Their body pampered for the whole day. And afterwards, when they got back to the university, they gave them a standard psychology test to find out who was the most relaxed. You know what they found? Those people who went to the spa were far more relaxed and healthy and peaceful than those who went to the retreat. They said, what the heck is going on? But not my retreats. They're really nice and peaceful because, number one, we don't aim to get somewhere. Instead, our purpose is to be more fully where we already are. To let go, to be here, to be still. The only place you can find any peace is right here, right now. So, we all know that. But why is it that when we go and do some meditation, we forget all of the Buddhism, the Dhamma we've ever read, and we do something different? We strive. And when you strive, you will get tense. There are two types of meditation. Who knows what those two types of meditation are? Two types of Buddhist meditation. Wonderful. You already know that every question I ask is always a trick question. It's best to be silent. Most people say samatha vipassana. I say no. Two basic types of meditation. Second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. What's second noble truth? Craving, wanting leads to suffering. So why is it that when we meditate, we want something, we crave, we aim for something, and we think, something must be going wrong. I'm not happy. Of course not. You're wanting something, which means you are doing second noble truth meditation. Third noble truth meditation. Letting go. It's learning how to be content and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. You remember that, Gopi? From the translation of the Metta Sutta, loving kindness. And if you do something like that, you're content, easily satisfied, this is good enough for me, you let go, you relax to the max. You're peaceful, and you end up getting very happy, very still, closer and closer to the ultimate happiness, because you're following the right path of letting go, renunciation, giving up, just being. In all the places I go, Desmond, it's very rare to see human beings. Hong Kong, Penang, Singapore, Sydney, London. There's very few human beings in our world. There are many human goings, many human doings, many human worryings, but very few human beings just being here. The second and third noble truth, I forget, it was apparently a philosopher, but a long time ago, I forgot the name. When you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. Beautiful way of putting in the second and third noble truths. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And the thing with meditation, it's supposed to be not more stress. It's not something a Buddhist does, like going to the dentist to get a checkup. Because I'm a Buddhist, I'm supposed to go to meditation. No, it's something you enjoy doing. You get fun and happiness from. So how does that actually work? There is a simile, I borrowed it from Vajrayana, but we don't own anything. We share everything. So that was a simile of the thousand-petal lotus. And a lotus is closed up at night time. Got any lotus images here? Probably somewhere. A lotus is closed up at night time. And when the first rays of the sun strike the outermost sheath of the lotus, then it starts to open up. And when the outermost sheath, which is always very rough and coarse, opens up, that reveals the next layer of petals. So they can receive the warmth and light of the sun. So they open up, so the light and warmth of the sun can hit the next layer of petals. They open up stage by stage, just because of the warmth and the light of the sun. And that stands for your body and mind. The warmth and light of the sun stands for kindness and mindfulness together. Not just mindfulness, but the kindness as well. That opens things up. And as it opens things up, just be kind and aware of your body. How are you feeling? It's okay to fidget in meditation. Relax to the max. Because then when you're nice and comfortable, your body disappears. It's not a problem anymore. That sheath of the lotus, your body, opens. I was teaching a meditation retreat over in Perth, and this gentleman came, and not the sort of person I'd expect to come on one of my retreats. Okay, I was judging him. I admit that. I was being ridiculously stupid. Should never do that, but I was taught my lesson later on. This fellow was really big, rough, tattoos all over him, looked like some sort of Hell's Angel, and wearing Australian national dress, which was just sandals, shorts, and a dirty old singlet. And I said, because not far from our monastery, there's an open prison, Karnak Prison Farm. So I told him, I said, oh, excuse me, sir, but I think you got the wrong place. The prison is up the road. I just stereotyped him straight away. He said, no, I'm on your retreat. Really? I checked there, oh, he's on. Okay, fair enough. So off he was on there, my retreat. One of the roughest persons I ever thought would come on my retreat. And then later on during the retreat, he came for his interview and he told me just what he was going through in his meditation. Oh, wow. He'd open up his lotus so far, he was in the jhanas. Blissed out of his mind, totally unaware of what's going on around him, but really aware of what's happening inside. The last person I'd ever expect. Because I was stupid and judged people. And that taught me a lesson. Doesn't matter who you are. How long you meditated. What race, religion, age, or how many tattoos you have on you. Because how can you judge a lotus on the outside? It can be rough, dirty, because it has to weather the storms. But when it opens up, even the roughest of lotuses has these beautiful petals inside. And the deeper you go, the more beautiful they are. So this is actually what happens on a meditation. We're sitting there, we're just being kind, being aware, not doing stuff, not aiming for stuff. That's not being kind. That is trying to force yourself. Come on, you've only got a few moments left. You have to get somewhere. All those people who come on retreats, they pay a lot of money. They sort of have to sacrifice so much, have to beg to get permission from their husbands or their wives or their bosses to take the time off. And if you go back afterwards, say, what happened? They say, nothing. What, you mean you spent your holidays just having to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning or earlier, not having any dinner in the evening, no TV, no internet, not, you can't even talk? That's not that. Even in prison they allow you to talk. And you've volunteered for that and paid money for it. So people want to get something out of retreat, so they struggle too hard. But when you realize, just relax to the max. And as you're meditating, it's amazing, when you stop trying, things happen. That's the interesting thing. I'll just go into how these jhanas happen. Ajahn Chah used to say, Ajahn Chah, the great teacher, he said his forest, Wat Pa Phong, was like a mango orchard. And the trees had been planted by the Buddha, which was a metaphor, obviously. And he said that those mangoes, the mango trees, were just full of juicy, sweet mangoes. So ripe, so incredibly delicious. But, he said, you cannot climb the tree to get one of those mangoes. You cannot shake the tree to get it to fall. You cannot get a cherry picker. It doesn't reach that high. Or you cannot get like a bamboo pole or throw something at the bamboos to get them to fall. There's only one way, and one way only, to get those bamboos to fall and eat them. And that is to sit perfectly still under the mango tree and hold out your hand and a mango will fall. That, I thought, was so ridiculous. No, you know mango trees. If I sat under a real mango tree over in Penang and just crossed my legs and opened my hand, I'd be there for hours and days. And if it did fall, knowing my luck, probably on my head. Never my hand. That's ridiculous. But then afterwards you realize the metaphor. The only way to get those deep meditations is to sit perfectly still and open up your heart. And then all those wonderful states, they just come to you. You try and struggle and climb that tree or shake it, and nothing ever happens except just frustration and thinking that you can't meditate. So instead, we learn how to sit here, relax our body, really care for your body. You don't have to sit cross-legged on the broken glass. Sit comfortably, relax, and really relax your body to the max. And then, what I introduced in Perth the last couple of years, always innovate a little bit here, a little bit there, to ask yourself, how peaceful are you in your mind? To start looking at what we call the peaceometer. You have a thermometer, just, you know, how warm or cold this room is. You have a speedometer on your car. You have so many meters. What about the peaceometer? So right now, how peaceful are you? 1 means, you know, you're really peaceful. 10 means you're really agitated. 0 means you're dead. 20 means you're psychotic. How peaceful are you right now? Now, it doesn't really matter what the number is. It just means you have to be mindful. Put your attention on that part of your mind called how peaceful you are. You start to become aware of one of the most important parts of your mind, how peaceful or how agitated it is. And from that, what makes your mind more peaceful? What makes it more agitated? What is the cause of peace? And you see, trial and error, try this, try that, and you find out when the needle goes closer to 1, when the needle goes up to 10. Why? You're learning from by your own experience that striving goals just makes you more tense. The needle goes up. Relaxing, letting go, the needle goes down. Just like the Buddha said, let go. Just be in this moment and be kind. And then you find your mind relaxes. You don't need to go places. You're already here. When I say that I'm on an aircraft tomorrow going to Penang, I don't go anywhere. The aircraft does. I just sit there, still. Wherever I am, I'm always here. Just here sometimes to be different. Sometimes here is very wet and I get drenched. Tomorrow here will be very hot and I'll go sweaty. So, you're always here. The outside changes. You always remain here in this moment. And then you find you're going into the lotus. So you go into the lotus, into your body, that opens up, usually into time, the present moment, that opens up into silence. What was in your mind a moment ago? You were silent, you weren't thinking, because you didn't know what I was up to, when I was going to start talking again. Silence. Can you experience the silence? And it's very easy. It's very beautiful. And you know it's profound. So don't disturb the silence. One thing I always noticed when I used to go to listen to great music was I could not give a comment while the music was being played. If I said anything, wow, that's amazing, I'd have lost track of the flow of the music. I'd also probably be thrown out of the theatre or the concert hall. You had to be silent to listen to great music, which is one of the reasons why it was enjoyable. I didn't realise until later on when I started to become a monk and meditating, why one of the most important enjoyments of listening to great performance was it was so enjoyable you couldn't think. You didn't think. Afterwards, you maybe had some ideas of what to say about it. During the performance, you were silent. And only in the silence can you fully enjoy and appreciate great music. Only in the silence are you really alive. Because you're not talking back to nature. You're listening to nature. You're feeling her. You're there experiencing it without talking back. So, you go deeper into the silence. That's another layer of petals. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. And you go deeper. You know what happens next? You get the beautiful breath. Because nothing else is happening. And because you're not doing very much, another thing happens in meditation, before we actually get into the real amazing stuff, as you're just watching this lotus open up little by little, because of mindfulness and kindness, you find you get deeper into more beautiful, fragrant petals. And then even the breathing becomes very delightful. Weird. Why? And it's because, and I've noticed, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour. That's William Blake, 17th century, artist and poet, mystic. I don't know what he was doing, but he certainly, you know, was on the money, as they say. Because that's what happens. When you get very peaceful and still, even a grain of sand looks beautiful. A flower just blows your mind. It's amazing what you see there. Because stillness empowers your mindfulness. You're like you're waking up. You see more. You appreciate more. And even when I was on a retreat over in Perth recently, after finishing the retreat, just beautiful energy. For breakfast, I had baked beans. I like baked beans because we always say, may all beings be happy and well. And I like the beans to be happy and well in my tummy. All beans, baked beans, runner beans, soya beans, may all beans be happy. But anyway, there I was. And this is no exaggeration. I put the first just one baked bean in my mouth. And wow, I never tasted a baked bean, which was the texture, which was just so soft. But it wasn't sort of mushy. It was just the right texture. And the tomato sauce on it, it wasn't too sweet, no too salty. It was a tangy taste of a tomato, a little tiny bit of acid. and just the way that everything came together. I've never tasted a single baked bean, just such a taste explosion. I thought it must have come from some Jamie Oliver or some celebrity chef until I finally found out it was from a can of Heinz baked beans. Why? It's because when you have a lot of stillness, your awareness really becomes strong. So actually, when you're opening up that lotus, you're really getting a strong mindfulness. And everything looks delightful. Things which you never thought of would be delightful were full of joy to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower. And this is nature. The deeper you go into that lotus, the more beautiful it is. Just because your mind is waking up and getting powerful. And when it gets very, very powerful, because you're enjoying yourself so much, that you don't need to do anything. You're relaxing to the max, you're conserving your energies. And energy, instead of flowing in to what I call the doer, the active part of your mind, judging, planning, thinking, trying to understand and take notes, you're just knowing. Pure mindfulness with kindness. And that light, that becomes incredibly bright. You don't need to do much breathing because you're just like a car in a garage, just idling, purring without expending too much energy. More energy, and so the joy just takes off. For anyone who is Ajahn Brahm making this up, just have a look at stuff like the Anapanasati Sutta. Stage 5, 6, 7, 8 are all about getting piti sukha, joy and happiness up, bliss up. Getting more and more and more. Until then you get into the juicy stuff. The nimittas and the jhanas. Seeing this light, this chitta arise. The mind, people have all sorts of ideas what the mind is. But this is, you're experiencing it. Prabhasara, radiant, beautiful, gorgeous. And that sometimes scares people. Because sometimes, what the heck's going on? I can't feel my body. You're going into places you haven't been before. That's wonderful. So after a while it's just, well, what the heck, the joy is really good, so let's go for it. So these wonderful lights come in your mind and your body just starts to fade away and disappear. And I always say that each one of you will experience a nimitta sooner or later when you die. Going towards the light. That's the same thing. Because, but you know, when you're doing meditation, you don't die, you come back again, there's no problem. But when you're going towards the light, your five senses stopping at death. When you are doing the meditations, your five senses are being calmed down. So you're not aware of them. And you get these beautiful experiences of the light. Very powerful. And now you're going on the doorways to the deep meditation, the jhanas. They even call the eight vimokas. Vimokas means the releases, freedoms from this body. Now you're really going to bliss out to the max. You don't do anything. Stillness upon stillness upon stillness. Peace upon peace upon peace. That's why Ajahn Chah was again on the money, just because sitting perfectly still and opening up the door of your, opening up your hand, the kindness, the openness, to let these things come in. For many of you, you'll be scared. Fear will come up, just like that lady yesterday at our retreat. Terrified. For two reasons. Number one was because the power of the states, the bliss of it. And I can understand that, because sometimes you think, this is too much fun. It can't be right. This is Buddhism. This is religion. Religion is not supposed to be fun. It's a weird thing, isn't it? We always go for asceticism. And if you're happy, stop it. Now. Once in Hong Kong, after I gave her some talks and retreats for the first time, in one of these temples, Wang Fa Chi Temple. And it was, it was in Kowloon side, but I think Suen's, I forget the name of the part of Hong Kong. But anyway, this poor elderly Chinese nun, she came out to me afterwards, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Why? And she said, because after you came, now I could smile and laugh. Before, if I smiled and laughed, I'd get told off by my disciples. A nun is not supposed to be happy. But now you came, I can say, well, Ajahn Brahm is happy, so I can be as well. Why is it that people think you have to be miserable? So anyway, that when we actually learn just to have a bit of fun and joy and inspiration and happiness, that is part of the path, happiness. And when you have that happiness in the meditation, it's just so enjoyable. But sometimes you don't want to get out of meditation. It's not like you're doing this because you're trying to beat your personal best of how many hours you can sit meditation. It's not a competition. You sit long because you're enjoying it, having great joy and happiness. And that turns into huge, beautiful nimittas, amazing lights. And when you get sucked into those, you're in these jhanas, bliss. And each one of those jhanas is a different flavor of bliss. Just like ice cream has different flavors. And when I first got into a first jhana, the body is a long way gone. You can't feel it anymore. It's one of the reasons why when a person dies, please don't be afraid of death. The process, you know, is uncomfortable. Once you get to that death moment, your five senses have gone. You're free, liberated from the aches and pains of a body. And if you want to know what I'm talking about, aches and pains of the body, just look at all the people. Somebody is adjusting their glasses and scratching their nose. You are doing the nose as well. Another person is just scratching their ear. That was the cameraman. How busy are people on their body trying to find comfort? If you have a look, they're always moving. And we're so used to that, scratching their nose, moving this, fiddling that. We're so used to it that we take it for granted. We don't even notice it. The body is always demanding attention of us, even when we're sleeping, tossing and turning. We are very active because our body is very hard to find, scratching the nose. It's okay, I do the same thing. But can you be really still? So the body just disappears. That's what happens in the jhanas. The body's gone. And it's peaceful, free. Not only that, thought has gone a long time ago. And that first jhana is so peaceful, so joyful. But part of that is that your ability to do stuff will. It's also so disturbing, having to make decisions, having to choose. In fact, that sometimes we cherish our will, but a lot of times we can't just let it go and be peaceful. Can you stop worrying when you go to sleep at night? People who are meditating, can you just drop all the stuff which is not important at all and just leave it alone and just be? So that peace is also incredibly powerful. And what happens is that there are some people like St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, and other people throughout history, sometimes they do get into those jhanas, blissed out. And they come back and say, well, I wasn't there. There was no sort of me left there. And it was so blissful. And sometimes, not just blissful, but just, people often say it's just like pure love. It's another term for bliss, an ecstasy. You're so loved you don't have to do anything because there's nothing to do. And those are the people who they make saints. And I was saying just how unfair it is to Buddhists. If you were a Christian and enter the first jhana, the archbishops and the popes would say, oh, that's union with God. And so they name a train station after you, because on the way here we went through St. Paul's train station. And even like a hospital, and even sort of a school. You'd have a St. Chandra's school, or St. Chandra's hospital, if you go into the Chandra's. Because that's what it feels like. Did any of you read that little story of Murali? It was Murali, the Hong Kong girl, dying to live. Anita Mujani, yeah. Anita Mujani. She was had all these tumors in her. She was really a piece of work. And she had so many operations, and then one operation she sort of died on the operating table. Now floating out, she could hear what the doctors were saying, and then sort of they were really stunned. It was in Hong Kong where she had her operation, even though she was an Indian national. And then she floated off into this incredible light, so bliss and so loved. And she said that was union with God. He said, in that beautiful state, peace, joy, nothing to do, anything, just so much happiness. She came back and she realized that the cause of her cancers was trying to please others, trying to be perfect, trying to be something she was not. And she realized that was the cause of her illness. And apparently when she came out afterwards and came to consciousness, the first thing she told her physician, who was surprised that she came out of the near-death experience, to say, I'm cured. What do you mean you're cured? You know, you got cancer, you just almost died. You got tumors all over you. I said, no, I've seen the reason for my illness. It's gone now. The cause was gone, and the tumors just started shrinking. And then she was free. Interesting, the insight which came from those deep experiences. Why? Are you always trying to live up to other people's expectations? Trying to be something you're not. You can imagine the tension and tightness there. So, stop trying to live up to other people's expectations. Stop trying to be perfect. There's a t-shirt which I love. It was over in Australia, I first saw it. The first line was, nobody is perfect. Second line, I am a nobody. Third line, therefore I am perfect. That's the sort of logic I like. So that means that when you bliss out, you do get a lot of happiness as well, insight as well. And also, when you come out of deep meditation, these things they call the five hindrances, especially this wanting and denial, otherwise known as aversion. They are just taken out for a while. They are just not there, which means you don't see what you want to see, nor do you see what is a shock for you. You see what's there. That's why even the Buddha always said from the jhanas, samadhi pachaya yata bhuta yana dasana. I don't just tell jokes, I do know my Pali as well. From the stillness, from especially the jhanas, you see things as they truly are. When I was in Korea, I was listening to the translation of one of the head monks of the Jogje Order, and he was an amazing man. He had, just to show how tough he was, he'd actually burnt off one of his fingers under a candle. If that wasn't enough, he did a second one as well. He only had three fingers on one hand. So these, you know, they're not sort of, they're very tough monks. But he was in his sermon, he said something which, you know, it's in the Jokje Korean Zen tradition as well. He said that, if you want to see the full moon and the stars at night, the best place to see them is as a reflection in a lake up in the mountains. but the lake has to be perfectly still. If there is a ripple on the surface of that lake, the image of the moon and the stars will be distorted. But if you're fortunate enough to go to a lake and it's a still night, there's no wind, and the lake isn't trembling, it's like a mirror, like a perfect glass smooth mirror, and then you see the accurate, undistorted reflections of the moon and the stars. So that's like sort of the stillness required to get the deep insights. So still that your mind perfectly reflects the truth, whatever that truth is, and it's not my job to tell you. Otherwise, it starts arguments. So instead, we learn how to go even deeper into the bliss states, the seven steps to heaven. So the first thing, this is so heavenly. You ain't seen nothing yet, as Ronald Reagan used to say. Because you always think there can't be nothing better than that. But when things are still, they start to disappear. If you don't click the mouse on your computer, the screen turns off. Stillness also leads to disappearance. I first learned that at Throstle Hole, up in Northumberland, when I went on a retreat, a Zen retreat, and there, a Shasta Abbey group, and Kenneth Roshi. You know, she used to come here a lot when she was still alive. Actually, she started here, I think, didn't she? Kenneth Roshi?
Well, she had a strong connection.
Yeah, I think I remember that. But anyway, so she had a little retreat center over in the Northumberland. I went there once, and I didn't know what I was doing. It's great when you don't know what you're doing, because then you are open to whatever's going to happen. So I was asked to sit with your eyes open, facing a wall, and that was it. See what happened next. So I was young, adventurous, my eyes were open, sitting there. I learned how to do enough meditation just to be still, not to think, not to worry about anything, but just be in the moment, just watching this whitewashed wall. And then the wall vanished. It wasn't there anymore. It disappeared. That was weird. But in those days, 60s, 70s, that was cool. Weird rot. But what was actually happening there was strange, but it's obvious. It's just science. If nothing moves, your brain just turns off. It's very efficient, the way it sort of uses its cognitive faculties. Nothing moves, gone. So I just, because nothing was moving, my sight turned off. Sound turns off. Taste, touch, turns off. Smell as well turns off. So five senses turn off because of stillness, nothing moving. And then, what's left? Your mind. That's really cool. And then, what happens is you see these nimittas and you go into the jhanas, because there it's a lot of stillness. If you stay in the first jhana long enough, because of stillness, you get into a second jhana. And the second jhana is weird, incredibly beautiful, because it's born of stillness. Nothing is moving there. The first jhana is a little wobble, as I call it. So it's even more bliss and happiness. Stillness, and how much power you get from stillness. Third jhana. It's, you think you understand what happiness is, but part of happiness, which is a disturbing part, it's called pity, vanishes. You're aware, mindful, and happy. Which, if anyway, if you read those descriptions, is why the Aryas, enlightened ones, say that you are happy and mindful and equanimous in that state. Making the point, these aren't dull states. Incredibly powerful mindfulness. A lot of happiness. And because it's still, the happiness vanishes. Pure equanimity of mindfulness. Is that boring? Yeah, people say, The Buddha said it's equanimity, contentment. But then again, he also said the bliss of contentment. It's another flavor of happiness. And when you start getting into these states, the first state you think, you can't be any higher than this. This is bliss. This is union with God. This is the ultimate. And some people think they're enlightened. You're not enlightened. You're not a saint. There's more to go. That's the interesting part of this. You're really getting into the deep happinesses and blisses. And why? So anyway, and then you go, that's the fourth heaven. And then you go into that fourth jhana. Because it's so still, stay there long enough and more things start to disappear. Your mind starts to disappear. You start to lose your mind. But people, that's negative, you know, losing your mind. It doesn't mean you go crazy. It means this thing which you call consciousness starts to unravel. And it's already, will is unraveled. And it's that here I'm going to pause for the why is there insight? What's the point of this? Just to bliss out, that's all. And the simile which I came up with was the tadpole and the frog. So once upon a time, in the back of a wonderful Buddhist center in Eccleston Square, they had installed a little pond. Have you got a garden in the back? A gun? Have you got a pond in there?
We've got some water in
there. Water, okay, that's good enough. There's a pond there. And anyway, there was a tadpole was born in that pond. And little tadpole was really smart. And the older tadpoles and would actually teach it had to go to school. And did O levels in chemistry and then A levels and then did so well. Went to university in the pond where it studied chemistry and did a PhD in water. At the same time, being in the back of a Buddhist center, would hear many talks on the four elements, such as water and Abhidharma as well. So really understood water. Everything there was to know about water, that tadpole was the expert. But how could a tadpole really know what water is? No more than a fish can. Fish spent all its life in the water, grown up in the water. How do you know what water is? Well, the difference between the fish and little tadpole was one day tadpole grew appendages, little stumps, first in its shoulders and then in its bottom. It was growing legs and arms. It was turning into a frog. And one day, little frog, not really knowing what it was doing, decided just to let go and jumped out of the lake. And that was the weirdest experience ever for little frog. It was like nothing she'd experienced before. Dry land. It was born in the water, lived all its life in the water, studied in the water, and knew everything. She thought she knew everything about the water, but when the water disappeared, that was spooky. But only now could little frog understand what water truly is. Once it disappeared. Otherwise, could not notice it. Once it disappeared, then could get insight into the nature of this strange thing which was no longer there. Do you think you really understand your body and five senses? It's always there for you. Only when it disappears can you understand what they really are. When people become monks and nuns, they say, what are you doing that for? Get a life out, Champa. Look, no, you're young. You're still attracted. Get a... Okay, well, I don't hear that these days. Why'd you leave the world? Oh, okay, crocky. Anyway, that's how the tadpole becomes a frog and becomes enlightened. That's what water is. Just like you get a jhana when the body disappears, then you can understand what the body is and the five senses. When will disappears. Second jhana. No will there. Gone. Not there. Not will. That's where you understand what will is. Chetana. Sankara. Will. Gone. Spooky. Weird. Sometimes frightening when I say this. But nevertheless, it's disappeared. That's how you understand it. You can study it, but it's always there for you. You haven't jumped out of that lake. And then further down the track, your mind, consciousness. Do you really understand what it truly is when it's always there for you? You may have theories, but then it starts to go, unravel, little by little. And you know the more it disappears, the more bliss it is. The more happiness, the more joy. Oh, what freedom to be free of the will, just to be still. Oh, what bliss to see your mind vanish. That's why if you go deeper and deeper into the middle of the lotus, amazing, unexpected, refined petals, until finally you get to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme means the jewel in the lotus. And when it opens up, that's where you see the jewel in the heart of the lotus. You know what that is? Ajahn Chah, had a great meditation because he'd just been giving an inspiring talk. Meditated for 2 hours, blissed out what I should have been doing, my services for him. But after I finished my meditation, I got up, went looking for Ajahn Chah, and that's when we crossed. And he looked at me, and he obviously knew I'd just come out of a very beautiful meditation. And so he decided to check me out. Monks can read minds. But don't worry, nuns as well, maybe. Some people's minds are not worth reading. It's like going to an old bookshop and saying, oh, this is rubbish. They don't have to worry. But that time, my mind was worth reading. So it's weird, but I don't mind saying this. You can feel Ajahn Chah getting into your mind. And that's how you felt. And for once, I was happy. Come in, have a look around. You know, I was really tidy this time. I was like, no, keep out. I'm not ready. And after checking me out, he looked at me. Brahma Wangso, that's the full name, without the Ajahns and other stuff. I was going to say that I actually signed the book today, His Sogginess, Ajahn Brahm, because I was really wet when I came in here today. So I signed His Sogginess. Anyway, Brahma Wangso, why? He asked me the question, why? That was really amazing. A great teacher was getting no messing around, getting to the heart of things. Why? And I looked at him and I answered. The answer came straight from within. I don't know. I was a very silly monk, stupid monk. I thought I was really clever, but I could meditate, but wisdom was very weak. I don't know. A nice thing about great masters, whenever they have stupid disciples, it just entertains them no end. That was our purpose, our Western monks, just to make a laugh and laugh. So he just laughed his head off. And then afterwards he stopped. He looked at me again serious and said, I'll tell you the answer. Wow, this was really cool. He was going to tell me the answer to the question why. Straight from a great monk, just personal, just Ajahn Chah and I. Wow, this is amazing. And I was so excited. Yes, yes. And he said, the answer to the question why is, there's nothing. There's nothing. He looked at me, you know, with great compassion. Do you understand? And I said, yes, yes. And he said, no, you don't. And he walked away. So what is the jewel in the heart of the lotus? There's nothing. It's empty. Nothing there. Do you understand? No, you don't. Okay, that's a talk so far, because I've got another appointment. My brother's going to be outside at 8:30 looking for me. Any questions, comments or complaints? Questions are no extra charge. Ah, come on. Yeah, very good, yeah.
Can you become addicted to being in the jhana? Is that a danger? Do you consider?
Haha, great question. Can you be addicted to being in the jhanas? The answer is yes. It's stated in the Pasadika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. The Buddha said, if anybody asks you, monks and nuns, can you be addicted to the pleasures of the jhanas? You should answer yes. Because you're telling the truth. Then what happens to you if you are addicted to the pleasures of the jhanas? Only four things can happen to you if you're addicted to the pleasures of the jhanas. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. The four stages of enlightenment. That's what happens if you indulge in the jhanas. That's pretty neat, isn't it? You get enlightened. That's what you're supposed to do. That's our duties. So you get the great pleasures of the jhanas, and that actually is the way. Beautiful pleasures. So the Buddha said in many places, such as the Mahamalunkyaputta Sutta 64 of the Majjhima Nikaya, where he said, these jhanas, the bliss of jhanas, na bayitabhang, asayitabhang, bahudikatabhang, bhavetabhang, they are not to be feared. Because they're so pleasurable. They are to be followed, developed, made much of. He says that not just once, many times in the Ataka Nagara Sutta, many other places. So great when you actually see it there. Wow, that's what you should be looking out for and developing. The happiness of renunciation, the stillness. You know, another thing, just from the suttas, this was really sort of wow when I sort of read this sort of stuff from the Buddha, that he described just the bliss, the happiness of even the first jhana. He called it Sambodhi Sukha. Sambodhi means happy, means enlightenment. He called that experience enlightenment happiness. And you know, quite frankly, that you know, with all the great respect that obviously I have to a Buddha, that exaggerating it a bit, but it's close enough to give you a taste of what it's like to be totally free, enlightened, gone. Even the first jhana happiness. It's really powerful. That's one of the reasons why, if any of you have the good fortune to get one of those, it blows you away. It's big stuff. So I say it's the sort of stuff which you be called a saint. They're not that hard to get. In the time of the Buddha, how many people they said were getting enlightened? Non-returners, once-returners. You read those books. Why isn't it happening today? You guys, lay people, men, women. Why isn't it happening today? Are you somehow different? Is it all the best enlightened beings? They got the creme, you know, in the time of the Buddha, and it's only just, you know, the dregs of humanity left. Is that the case? No way. And the last thing just is, how does this happen? Because first person, lay person, who told me, and it's obvious that what they did was correct, got into this amazing jhana. What do you do special this time? And they said, they let go. They really let go. The second person, lay person, I asked the same question. What did you do special this time? They gave the same answer. They really let go. The third one said something similar. So I stopped asking after that. You're really letting go. Letting go of all control, all doing. All choosing, just being. and disappearing. Just like you're driving a car, and it's this disciple over in Perth had this dream, driving a car, and it's going at full speed over a cliff, and I'm in the passenger seat, and I tell them, take your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. I can't, we're going to die. Take your feet off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. Ba 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 ba. And in the dream, she actually did that. She took her feet off the steering wheel. Feet off the steering wheel, that's the wrong way around. Hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. And we went right over the cliff. Incredible speed. And at the bottom of the cliff, you know, it wasn't sort of a flat, it sort of bent a little bit. But you know, the car could maybe sort of take that bend, take that sort of curve, and sort of flatten out. But then there was a really sharp right-hand bend. So as we were careering down, we managed to take the fall and sort of level off. But then as soon as she came across this really sharp right-hand bend, she went to go and take the put a hand on the steering wheel. I said, hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. And in her dream, the car turned by itself and carried on perfectly without any problem. So well done. Now, don't do that in the Australian traffic, but when you're meditating, try that, really let go. It's scary sometimes to let go because you're out of your comfort zone. And it's also many of the dangers you think, something's going to happen to me. No, relax. See what happens. List out of your head. Trouble is, we're such control freaks. We always interfere. That's one of our problems. Okay. If you want to hear any more, then we have this amazing disciple, Venerable Chanda, who will answer any of the tough questions once I'm gone. Okay.
Thank you very much for coming. It was a wonderful talk. Thank you all too. Don't forget begging bowl on the way out. And come again.
Letting go bowl.
Can we wish you a very happy journey and happy season on the festivities.
Happy Buddhamas.
Happy Christmas.
Yeah, good. Great, excellent. Okay, so what time is it? It's 20.
Well,
okay.
In a few minutes your brother will be in the
chair. Okay, yes. Okay.
Got a few minutes.
7 minutes. Okay, can I do one more letting go story? This fellow, I reminded of it just a few moments ago. He fell off the cliff. When he fell off the cliff, he managed to grab onto a little branch hanging from the cliff. And he looked down, it's a long way down, certain death. He looked up, there's no way to clamber back up. So he started shouting out for help. Help me, help me! Shouting and shouting until he heard this voice from the heavens. I will help you, boomed this voice from above. But you have to have faith.
I have faith, I have faith, he said.
I've got to test your faith. Let go of the branch. And he looked down. It's a long way down. So he looked up again and shouted, anyone else up there?